Mental illness continues to be a major issue in our society, and despite diagnosis, people distressed by these illnesses often do not seek out services or choose to fully engage in them. One major factor are the complex elements of stigma preventing people from engaging in multiple treatments for their mental health issues. And the impact of mental health can prevent us from leading our most full and productive lives. Pat Corrigan co-authored a study called The Impact of Mental Illness Stigma on Seeking and Participating in Mental Health Care. And one interesting finding from the article shows that people with seemingly less severe social anxiety disorders may experience a worse course than those with the prototypic serious illness, such as schizophrenia, because the fright and nervousness defining their anxiety prevents them from seeking even the least demanding of job, thereby rendering them unable to live on their own. Pat Corrigan is a distinguished professor of psychology and the core faculty member in the Division of Counseling and Rehabilitation Science at Illinois Tech. He joins me to discuss these findings and the impact of stigma. Welcome to Open Minds. Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. There's an article that you co-authored or wrote in 2014 called The Impact of Mental Illness Stigma on Seeking and Participating in Mental Health Care. And it begins with this statement: serious mental illness can lead to significant distress and disability that undermines the quality of life. In your opinion, what are some examples of significant distress and disability that some may not be aware of?
Well, I'd ask you to argue all you listeners experience mental illness. Major depression is about 20% of the population at any one time. Add in all the other ones, we're talking about a third. Add lifetime, you're talking about most everybody. Some people are significantly disabled by it. And what I mean by disabled by it is the result of their symptoms. They're not able to achieve their common life goals, which in our society, we pretty much agree is get through school, get a satisfying job, make a good income, have a relationship, have 2.3 children, move to the suburbs, and get a Cadillac. We all sort of agree those are what we're shooting for. And if mental illness gets in the way, then that's a pretty significant one. Quality of life is the idea that are we just satisfied in all the domains of life, putting aside mental illness, are we just satisfied with our work and our relationships and whatever our faith-based interests might be? And that's quality of life. And mental illness, for some people, when it's chronic or significant, can really interfere with that.
What are some of the interferences?
How can they interfere?
Yeah.
Well, if you look at psychiatry, psychiatry is pretty much the science of diagnosis and treatment. There's something called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible of diagnosis. And on the mental health side, they tend to identify certain clusters that are pretty significant in people. What was traditionally the cluster of serious mental illness for people in the schizophrenia spectrum. People with schizophrenia itself, which is a psychosis or other related disorders. There's also things that are more common to your listeners would be related to what call major affective disorders, affect synonymous with emotions. And the two big ones is depression and bipolar disorder. Anxiety disorder can be disabling. And then in more recent times, we've become aware of other significant disorders. Eating disorders can be disabling. Trauma can be disabling. Having any one of those diagnoses by itself does not necessarily mean you can be disabled and unable to go to work or get a job or whatever. Whether we're talking about schizophrenia or we're talking about anxiety disorder, it just hits some people in certain ways. So that a lot of people with schizophrenia are not able to get through school or get a job on their own or develop relationships. But even some people with anxiety disorder, some people who get anxious in school, can really interfere with their ability to finish school and get a job.
And that was something we'll come to later, low levels of anxiety and how that shapes quality of life. Another aspect that was mentioned in the article was the willingness to seek out mental health services. Research shows that respondents' desire to handle problems on their own is the most common reason given, both for not seeking treatment and for dropping out of care. I wanted to discuss this more, specifically why the desire to handle problems on our own is the most common reason for not seeking treatment.
Well, as I said when we started, I'm not sure I'm into superlatives like most. I think it's a good reason. I think it might especially be a Western tradition that there is this sort of hardiness on your own, being able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. There is a sort of popular belief that if you have a mental illness, you're weak, and so you shouldn't need to derail. In our own lives, we have periods where we get a little anxious or a little depressed, and we shake it off and go forward. And so a lot of people hope it is that. And some people can handle it on their own. But other people, and again, I would go back to two signs you need help. One is it sticks around for a while. And the other, it's getting away with your major life goals. Those are the kind of things that suggest people need help. What research shows is we now know there's a lot of evidence-based programs that can really help people pretty well. Actually, some of the research in antidepressants suggests they're as effective for depression as hypertensive drugs are for high blood pressure. That said, a lot of people choose not to go. Again, part of it is this, I can pull myself up by my bootstraps, and part of this thing is stigma. If I don't want anybody to know that I'm nuts, and the best way to know is to see me coming out of a psychiatrist's office.
Professor, how does one know when, let's say, anxiety or depression is getting in the way of their life? Sometimes it may not be noticeable, and others may notice it. But how does the individual start noticing that?
I agree sometimes people don't notice. I think you just want to do an inventory every so often. What do I want to do in life, big picture, and where am I at in that journey currently? Again, in the U.S., there tends to be this standard that adolescents and young adults are completing training or education so you can settle into a career. You then settle into the career. Somewhere along that line, you launch from your family of origin and find a significant other to partner with. And so I think you ask yourself, if somewhere along the line you're just stuck in school or stuck on a job or stuck in relationships or no relationships, you might want to ask yourself whether that's a mental health challenge.
That's fascinating because, again, for many people, that self-awareness may not always be there. So doing that inventory on a regular basis is very important. I was really fascinated by, first we'll get into defining serious mental illness. The literature notes, as you mentioned, in the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It really is. They should choose a different acronym.
Remember, this is DSM-5.
Five.
I actually was trained in DSM-2, which was 41 years ago. So they've been on the DSM for a long time.
Oh, geez. Yeah, that acronym's not going away probably for the next 40 years.
No, that's not going away.
It considers serious mental illness as the schizophrenia spectrum, anxiety and affective disorders, eating disorders, and personality disorders. However, research shows that illness severity, course, and outcome are defined not by diagnosis, but by distress, dysfunctions, and disabilities engendered by the disorder. So it's not the disorder itself, it's the distress and dysfunction.
I wanted to unpack that a little bit with you. Again, going back to how one understands that distress and dysfunction are happening in their daily lives.
Yeah, so I would sort of argue diagnoses themselves, unlike the rest of medicine, probably isn't that helpful. What is more helpful is understand in the individual when something's happening to them and it's interfering. There are lots of symptoms of mental illness. In schizophrenia, there are hallucinations, seeing things, delusions, not making sense. There's flat affect. In mania, there's this kind of euphoric whoop-de-doo sort of thing. I like to focus on anxiety and depression because despite all those other symptoms, those are the ones that upset you. People feel being anxious and they know what it is to be depressed and it's motivating and they want to fix it. And so in some ways, the distress, the anxiety and depression is a motivating thing to get to get to the therapist. Because think about it, if you're too depressed, you can't get out of bed and go to school. If you're too anxious, you can't think right and do well on a job. So those tend to be the upsetting sort of things. What makes it serious is what we said before. Again, I would wager to bet, I think it's a pretty safe bet, that everybody listening has had an experience with anxiety or depression. Loved one passed away, you have a hard time in school, you had a fight with your partner. For some of us, for complex reasons, it can be disabling. It can get in the way. Again, it means it lasts for a while. Some mental illnesses last for years and years and years. But generally, you know, if it lasts for a while, if you say to yourself, hey, you know, I was depressed 3 or 4 months ago and I'm still depressed. That's kind of a while because you've noticed it. And then it interferes with your goals. We all have goals. They vary amongst us. How does it interfere with your goals? I mean, another way to look at a goal I haven't talked about is recreation. It's fun. It's being with your friends. There's actually a symptom of depression where things used to be fun aren't anymore. If you used to love the bowl and now you just can't really do it anymore, that's kind of a symptom of depression and sadness. So it's when things get in the way of your individually defined goals.
And Professor, for many people, I always have these talks with my friends and family to say goal creation is so important. A lot struggle with goals and developing goals themselves, what they want out of their personal relationships, what they want out of their careers, what they want out of their social lives. That in itself is a struggle.
So well, that might be a yes and no. I mean, we all live in goals. So whether you like it or not, your parents imposed that upon you. The first day it kicked you off of school. There is a goal to go to school. There is a goal to get through to school. At the end of that goal, supposed to get through 8th grade. I guess that goal to get in high school. Once I get in high school, I sort of realize I want a career. This is all back there. You know, somewhere along the line, you look at people, if you have a mom and a dad, you look at mom and dad, see they pair up. Maybe I should pair up. So people are kind of pushed by goals, whether they can voice them or make sense of them might really vary. Might sometimes be a benefit of going into therapy.
Oh, that's fascinating, Professor. The other example in this article that I found truly fascinating was people with seemingly, quote unquote, less severe social anxiety disorders may experience a worse course than those with the prototype serious illness of schizophrenia because the fright and nervousness defining their anxiety prevents them from seeking even the least demanding of jobs, thereby rendering them unable to live on their own. Whereas some people with schizophrenia are able to live with recurring auditory hallucinations without distress, pursue a career, and enjoy a full family life. This was really fascinating, and I want to explore this further with you.
Yeah, Christopher, we're just, again, going into this issue of diagnosis generally by itself is not really that helpful. whether I put a schizophrenia label across your forehead or a social anxiety or dysthymic disorder or cyclothymic disorder, doesn't matter as much as whether because of that and because of the distress and the anxiety, which nobody thinks feels good, and because it gets in the way with your ability to get through school and the like, that's just what makes it serious. Now, generally, as a group, people with schizophrenia are going to have a much more serious time because hallucinations, delusions, formal thought disorder is a pretty big challenge. But there are people who with schizophrenia who live just fine. On the other hand, social anxiety, the kind of thing you notice the first day you go off to college and feel out of place, is generally kind of benign, but it can be kind of disabling for people. And so it's all based on the individual and what she or he wants to do.
Pat, you mentioned in this article that there are examples of anxiety that prevent people from attaining even the least demanding of jobs. Can you explain a little bit about how anxiety works for those that may not understand the disorder? Why someone would not pursue even the least demanding of jobs?
Well, let me reframe your question, because you said why they would not pursue, which sort of suggests they have a choice. And that sort of gets back to the old, if you're bucked up, you'd be able to pursue this. I mean, anxiety disorders usually have three components to it. One is the cognitive components, what your listeners will recognize as sort of going round and round and worry about things, perhaps kind of things that make it hard for you to fall asleep. The worst part of that would be obsessions. The second part of it is the gut-wrenching feeling of depression itself, which leads to the third part of it, which is the physical elements. One of it is for some people not being able to sit still. You just feel like you're going to explode. Other people feel it in their body. They get headaches or shoulder aches or the lot. Suffering with those things can really interfere with your ability to sit through school and pay attention to the teacher, or start a new job and learn all the components, or deal with your supervisor, who's always been a bit of a pain in the ass anyway. All those kind of things are harder when you're dealing with anxiety.
And Pat, how would you describe behaviors of low levels of depression for those that may not know?
So depression, too, has its physical, emotional, and cognitive components. The emotional ones is this ungodly sadness, that no matter what's going on, you find yourself tearful. It's also related to a big word, anhedonia. Hedonia means fun. Anhedonia means you're not having fun anymore. It's a guy who doesn't like bowling anymore. You just lose your joy of life. Those are the emotions. The attitudes are things like you feel helpless, worthless. You think as an individual you're a failure. You think there's no good future for you. And then there are the physical signs. Depression interferes with your sleep, can lead to either too much sleep or too little sleep, can interfere with your eating, with your sex drive. And then at the extreme, there's issues about suicidal ideation.
Pat, this all makes a lot of sense when it comes to treatment and seeking support. So in the article, it mentions approximately 20% of patients quit treatment prematurely, and over 70% of all dropouts happen after the first two visits. Do you see anxiety and depression playing a role in whether someone seeks care and sticks with treatment?
Well, anxiety and depression themselves, and the degree to which people experience it and understand it, in my guess, would be a big motivator to go into treatment, because it feels bad. People don't report like being anxious or depressed. You don't necessarily get that with an eating disorder or with schizophrenia, not necessarily. So I don't think that's why they drop out. I think they drop out for lots of reasons. One reason they drop out is the reason everybody has when you go try to buy a new car, don't like the car salesman, or go to the bank and don't like the new banker. Sometimes you just don't gel. And so we really encourage people to be picky about the therapist they seek out. If it doesn't feel right, go to someone else. Ask yourself ahead of time, would you prefer a man or a woman? With ethnic matching, somebody of your ethnic background be preferable. And if you get somebody who doesn't work, that's good. The second thing is, like a lot of physical illness, where we go into the doctor and say, hey, I got a cold, fix it, and then give you meds that tend to respond pretty quickly. Sometimes the course of a major depression, anxiety disorder is slow. And so people need to sort of hold on. That's one of the things a therapist will do with them. Third thing, though, is the stigma. Again, a lot of people are embarrassed for going in any way. As they've been in treatment, more and more people find out and how they explain it to them. And so they drop out.
I noticed in the research, too, that you were very specific to ensure the lexicon is correct, using the word adherence instead of compliance when it comes to seeking support. Why is it so important that we make sure that that distinction is there?
Well, the lexicon is even developed more. This is a 9-year-old paper. We don't like the idea of adherence anymore. We like the idea of engagement. There is the assumption that if you just took your meds, you'd get better. And then damn schizo patients, if they just took their antipsychotic medications, they would quit being psychotic. And that's really a stigmatizing attitude, and it's in general. Almost everybody who gets a prescription for the doctor at some point stops taking it. They don't like the side effects. They don't think they need it anymore. And so people with medication not taking their medication anymore because related to psychiatric disorder does not mean that's them being bad patients. It means maybe it's not working for them, or maybe they got second guesses, or maybe they need to go back to the psychiatrist and talk about it. And so the problem with adherence is if you're not adhering, you're assuming you're doing something bad. And so if I prescribe, well, I'm a psychologist, so I can't prescribe. If a psychiatrist prescribes an antidepressant for depression and you stop taking it, and the solution there is not to scold them and take your meds more. The solution is, why not? Why doesn't it work? Maybe another one to work better. Maybe you want to take a break. Maybe talk therapy would be better. And so what I like about engagement is engagement puts the responsibility on the professional, not on the patient. If the patient doesn't feel engaged, if the patient doesn't feel like they're getting something that meets their needs, then it's our responsibility to help them meet their need. One of the things we've really become aware of in the last 10 to 20 years is part of this can really be the lack of matching between the therapist and the ethnicity of the service recipient. Sometimes people just don't jive with somebody from a different culture. And so that's no indictment on the patient, absolutely. And no indictment on the professional, just that you need to be aware of that and think about how you're going to change the system and maybe get, for the African-American patient, maybe get an African-American provider.
Pat, I wanted to ask you more about engagement. I can understand why the dropout rates are so high. Over 70% of all dropouts happen after the first two visits. Do you think that engagement drops off because people become more aware of the amount of work they need to do on themselves after an initial engagement? Or is it that people aren't seeing the merit long-term of where ongoing therapy could be a benefit in their lives? Or is it something else?
Well, as a researcher, if I were doing the statistics, I would assume that if you're losing 70% off the top, what is remaining is the gung-ho folks. And so they've sort of sorted themselves in. And so I think that's why they're sticking. I would suspect there'd be a relationship, the degree to which people stay in treatment, the degree to which they've been in treatment before themselves, or they've had a respected loved one who's been in care and talks well about it. It really helps if your support system backs you up. For many people, faith-based communities are important. So if your faith leader says this is a good thing, that can really help. I think we need to be mindful of getting people into care and helping them stay there. We also need to be mindful if they choose to leave, we don't blame them. If I choose to leave the Ford dealer and go to the Mercedes-Benz dealer, the Ford dealer's missing the whole point if he thinks, well, you're just a bad customer. It's the same thing with people looking for care.
Agreed. Do you think, though, in the numbers we're seeing in terms of the dropouts, that in a way hinders the research in understanding why? I understand research is tough because what people say publicly and what they do privately can be two different things sometimes. And in this case, if we have that high level of dropout, understanding why the dropout is happening, was it the level of care, was it the level of service, what factors led to the dropout rates, that could limit the understanding of how effective the care was to begin with?
Yeah, so when you do research on a therapy, one of the standard therapies for depression is cognitive behavior therapy. One of the standard medications for depression is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, aka an SSRI. If you're coming up with a new one related to your question, the first question is feasibility, is if you offer it, will they do it? CBT is cognitive behavior therapy, which is traditionally an hour a week for as short as 6 weeks, as long as months. Do they drop out? If they drop out, it suggests there's something wrong with the therapy. If they're on a new medication, remember antidepressants are ubiquitous. For some reason, you got a new medication. Right now, there's some interest in ketamine as a new wonder drug for depression. You give it to a bunch of people and they stop taking it, that says something about the med. And so feasibility, will people do it, is a big research question whenever you're looking at interventions.
That's so important. I wanted to ask you about two important phrases used. One is label stigma and self-stigma. And I wanted to know what factors these play in seeking mental health support. First, a definition of label stigma and self-stigma, and what you see as the more prominent factor in seeking mental health support.
So in addition to being interested in how do we help people with serious mental illness get back on track, achieve their goals, in the last 20 years, I've become very interested in stigma and the pervasive effects it has. And so to understand stigma, we begin by defining it as terms of stereotypes, prejudice, and discrimination. The kind of things that apply to ethnic groups, to women, to LGBTQ, apply to mental illness. Stereotypes are a belief about a group. So I'm Irish American by heritage. The belief about Irish Americans is they're all drunks and abuse our family. Prejudice is agreeing with the stereotype. Yep, they're all drunks. Discriminations of behavior. There are then three types of stigma. You mentioned two. Let's talk about the big one first, is public stigma. It's what happens when the public agrees with the stereotype about a group. The big stereotypes about people with mental illnesses are dangerous because I don't want to be around them. They could flip out and hurt me. But it's also they're to blame for it, or they're incompetent or the like. That's the stereotype. The prejudice is agreeing with it, and discrimination is therefore I'm not going to hire them or have them in my class or want them to live where I'm at. Public stigma is what happens when the public agrees with the stereotype and discriminates against people with mental illness. Self-stigma is what happens with people who have a mental illness internalize the stereotypes and beat themselves up about it. Now we say it's hard enough being depressed, but if on top of that you're supposed to feel ashamed of yourself for it, just exacerbates the whole thing. And then label avoidance is what we're talking about in terms of engagement. There's this great sociologist named Goffman from the 1960s who defined stigma, and he said some stigmas are obvious and the other ones are hidden. The obvious stigmas, for example, is racial stigma. So if I'm in a group of 100 people, I can see who's of my race and who's not. Generally, gender is. I can tell who's male and who's female if I'm sexist, discriminate. Usually age is. The stigma of mental illness is fundamentally hidden. You can't tell who has a mental illness unless they disclose. And the way you disclose is by accident, by people knowing you're going to a doctor. So I'm going to avoid the label. So I'm not going to go see a psychiatrist, even though it'll probably help me out. That's label avoidance, stigma of labels.
You mentioned public stigma. How do we know when stigma, when public stigma enters the public consciousness? I guess that's a very nebulous question. Is it certain social behaviors that we start seeing more prominently in society?
Well, it's a very hard thing to survey. Okay, I want all of your listeners on a scale of 1 to 10 write down how bad are people with mental illness, where 10 is really bad. That's a stigma. Most people aren't going to do it. Because at least in our culture, you don't want to look like a bigot. That said, though, we still know there's ample evidence that employers won't hire people with mental illness because they're afraid they're going to flip out. Landlords won't rent to them. India is a culture, supposedly, you don't want to talk about mental illness in your family because it can interfere with your dating and your marriage partnerships. So those are all things that's evident that something's going on.
And that cultural element is so important because, as you mentioned at the top of the podcast, seeking out care, having care from an expert in from the similar ethnicity can really help unpack some of the mental health challenges you may have in navigating these issues relative to your specific culture, as an example.
Again, when I got out of school 35 years ago, I sort of thought I knew the basics that could help anybody anywhere, somebody in India, somewhere in China, somebody in Africa. And those were cognitive behavioral and other therapies, and they're good. But culture really defines the way the person understands the world. And so it's beyond presumptuous to assume some white guy in the United States can come up with an intervention that will easily ship off to another country. And so good interventions now are filtered through the lived experience of people from that culture. They may adapt interventions from here. What's a real big intervention in psychotherapy now is mindfulness, which pretty much comes more from an Eastern perspective. So vice versa, Westerners are adopting and learning from Eastern ways of doing things.
Yeah, the ancient traditions in Buddhism and Hinduism seem to be becoming more mainstream in Western culture today. On culture, one thing that was mentioned in the article was enhancing cultural competency for mental health practitioners. I can imagine that this is really challenging for mental health practitioners that are not connected to a patient from a different culture. How can we help along that trajectory for mental health practitioners to enhance cultural competency? But what is meant by enhancing cultural competency?
Well, that's a good question because, again, things mature. And I would no longer say cultural competency. I would say cultural humility. The old notion is the way I understand somebody from India is I understand the 10 basic rules of being Indian. And the minute I understood those 10 basic rules, I'd know all about Indians and I stopped listening to them. And the cultural humility begins with the assumption that that person in front of me is different than I am because of culture. And because of that, I need to let them know that we're different and I want to learn from you. And please don't hesitate to tell me anything I'm saying doesn't make sense to you. And I'll let you, I want to learn from you. When you really start thinking about that, though, that almost applies to everybody in the world. I mean, again, I'm Irish-American, but I could sit down with another Irish-American in front of me, and I think we think alike about things, and we don't. And so it's a general issue is humility is at the basics of good therapy. Listen to the person, learn from the person, be very careful about presuming things.
It's almost like you don't need cultural competency, quote-unquote, you just need to treat people with respect and listen to them, and that most likely will reveal more to you that way.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell a secret to your listeners. The number one skill you teach students in psychotherapy is listening skills, is being able to hear what the person is saying. And a lot of times we don't, because we all have filters that we're born with. But being able to hear what the person's saying and then reflect back that to them and see if they say, yeah, you know, that's right. Or, you know, not quite, Pat, maybe better this way. That kind of give and take can be a good first step in helping someone.
Pat, you end the article talking about anti-stigma efforts through legislation. Specifically at the time of writing, the Affordable Care Act was in the news. And the article mentions that the Affordable Care Act will dramatically help low-income communities access services. What role first does legislation have to play when it comes to those seeking mental health services outside accessibility based on, let's say, price or money as a barrier?
Oh, price and money is a barrier. Today is March 15th. I'd be curious how many people listened to NPR on the way to work today. I did. Because of COVID more or less coming to an end, Medicaid opportunities in many states are going away. In Florida, they say up to 1 million people will lose their Medicaid coverage. That is not trivial at all. If you want to go get help and you don't have money to pay for it, you're out of luck. And so that's what we mean about the hopeful benefits of the Affordable Care Act. And we still have a ways to go. It was a step in the right direction. But I think that's an issue of stigma, is it should be everybody's God-given right to go get help when they need it and to pay that provider for it.
Pat, forgive my ignorance. I'd love to explore this further. Is there research that shows that if the barrier of money were removed from low-income backgrounds, that they would then access mental health supports and services?
It's a huge barrier. Low-income people can't get the care they want. There is public sector care. I live in Chicago, and the Cook County Hospital provides care, but the waiting lists are forever. And so if there was better funds, you know, Obamacare is actually a step above Medicaid in terms of coverage. If more people could take advantage of that, that'd be a big step to helping people with mental health challenges. So let's go back to those people with serious mental illness. Because they have a serious mental illness, they're probably not able to work. So they're filtering down to low-income group. And so they're losing any kind of health care coverage that would help them keep from getting worse. So it's kind of a spiral.
Pat, you just mentioned something that was really fascinating. If only people would access those services, it would be better. I can understand, too, that people could go to Cook County Hospital and may see the lineups, may see the wait list, may see everything and just be completely turned off and may never re-enter Cook County Hospital again, or may say, I tried, it's not for me, I'm done with this. And the drop-off rate could be even higher as a result of the idea of engaging this administration or administrative barrier when it comes to mental health. Do you see that? Is that a fair critique of why some may drop off?
Yeah, but we're in the COVID times. This doesn't happen in the flesh. This happens when you try to call up someone. You call up a care organization. Half the time they won't call you back because they're swamped. The other half of the time they give you an appointment in 8 months. You get an appointment in 8 months. Psychiatrists are backed up forever. They do a preliminary and then they say they're going to see you again in 3 months, which somebody who's depressed, it's just not a good way to go. The system in the United States does not support healthcare in general and mental health care in particular.
And outside the barrier of income and money is the barrier of administration and other other factors that go into that. But you're right, someone who's fighting depression and anxiety are unlikely to kind of engage in that type of dialogue when seeking mental health care.
The other irony about depression and anxiety is, again, you know, a lot of people experience it. Someday you experience it and you finally had enough. It's just added up and it's really bothering you. And that's when you want help. And that's when you end up on the wait list.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. It's that critical moment. And that's an actually interesting perspective, because I do think that people are less likely to admit that they have an issue when the tide is low, and only go in when the tide is really high and they can't take it anymore.
I mean, the other issue when the tide is low, because you just don't know. Maybe you can live through it. I mean, everybody has anxiety. I got a meeting with the president of the university tomorrow. I'm anxious. But it may not be something I need to go into therapy for. I might just bully through it. On the other hand, if week after week after week I'm bullying through it and I'm beating all beat up, then that's probably something worth going to get help for.
Correct. Or having a conversation with Pat Corrigan, one of the top researchers and psychologists in America. I wanted to ask you about the need to start pre-service education, in-service training, and ongoing practice for mental health care workers. What is meant by pre-service education for mental health care workers?
So pre-service is grad school before you become a professional. So pre-service, that's not even true anymore. A lot of people become independent providers by getting a master's degree or a doctorate or an MD. And so all of that education's pre-service, is pre going out there and being a service. It's an opportunity to learn about people and to appreciate their challenges. And I would really suggest, since I've done it, pre-service training in terms of stigma, diversity has improved a lot. I mean, again, we had no concept, no discussion of diversity in the wonderfully diverse world out there. That permeates almost everything in graduate programs now. And then there's this concern about stigma and being aware that people sort of, they said, it's hard enough being depressed, but on top of that, you're supposed to feel ashamed of yourself. The shame of mental illness is a big deal, and that's stigma.
You mentioned diversity. I wanted to actually end on that. How have you found the new, I would say new, relatively new discussion on diversity impacting mental health care workers of the future or of the present right now?
So, you know, diversity, of course, is really complex because it depends on diversity in terms of what. Our first thought is in terms of ethnicity and race, which clearly is a big issue. Then it gets more complex in terms of gender identity. From the two-factor model, you're either male or female, to more non-conforming, transsexual, sexual orientation, age, education. Diversity appears in all sorts of different ways. Again, it's going back to cultural competence. You start by everybody realizing I come from a certain background. And so I'm going to naturally understand that background. I need to be humble when I'm sitting with somebody in front of me who's different background. And I need to say I need to be culturally able to meet them where they're at, not where I'm at.
And the final question I had for you, Pat, was the ongoing practice and the ongoing training that's needed for mental health care workers. What are some examples of ongoing ongoing practice that mental health care workers need to do to continue to make sure that they are kind of on top of not only their research, but also the changing factors happening in society writ large?
Well, one thing people may not know about is ongoing supervision is even when you get out of school, you get supervised at least once a week. When I had a practice, I was meeting with somebody else at least once a week to get a fresh view of stuff. Also, this can be a stressful job. And so the way to deal with a stressful job is to talk to someone else about it, to get their feedback, to see how you want to handle something. And then the field changes a lot. Again, one of the big field changes since I started working is this idea of mindfulness, which is permeating all sorts of new therapies. We need to learn about that sort of stuff. we need to be aware of our specialties. I tend to specialize in serious mental illness, but I'm becoming more and more aware of eating disorders. I'm not going to treat a person with eating disorder. I mean, unless they got nobody else to go to, and then we're just going to be trying to treading water. But I need to know enough about eating disorders so when I see somebody in front of me with it, I can provide immediate feedback and get them to somebody who does specialize in it.
These are really fascinating points, Pat. I keep trying to stop calling you Professor Pat. Thank you for that. I want to say, first of all, thank you for reviewing this article with me, shedding light on these really fascinating dynamics when it comes to both human behavior and also mental health, and how human behavior intersects with mental health. I think many people don't fully understand why low levels of depression or anxiety may in fact be preventing them from living their fullest life. And I think your research is helping people understand that that is in fact a major consideration that you should examine further when it comes to your life goals and objectives that you'd like to achieve. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts.
And I'd like to thank you for Open Minds. Any kind of podcast that helps the world around us better understand all the challenges and the ways they can decide to go forward is doing a valuable service. So thank you, Christopher.